Mary Beard is one of the world's most acclaimed classicists. Her writing on Rome has changed the way people think about the ancient world. And she's become one of the most recognizable public voices in the humanities through her writing and her work on television in the UK. She's now spent more than 60 years trying to understand the people and the politics and the everyday realities of ancient life. But her new book is different. It's not really a history or an argument about a particular moment in the ancient world. It's more personal than that. Beard has described it as something closer to a memoir than a thesis. It's a reflection on her life teaching and writing about the classics. And she can pinpoint the day it all started.
It was when I was 5, and I went to the British Museum with my mum. Like, you know, lurid 5-year-olds love the idea of the Egyptian mummies. And so my mum said, yeah, we'll go and see the mummies in the British Museum. But if we're going to see how the ancient Egyptians died, we should go and see how they lived too. We then went to the Everyday Life in Ancient Egypt Gallery. And we'd only walked in a few minutes when my mum said, oh my goodness me, at the back of that case, there's a piece of ancient Egyptian bread, 4,000 years old. Suddenly I forgot all about the mummies, and what I wanted to see was the bread, something that I knew about. At that moment, a bloke came along and he said, was I wanting to look at anything in particular? And I said, well, yeah, that piece of bread. And he must have been a curator because he put his hand in his pocket. He got a bunch of keys out. He opened the case and he brought out the bread. Yeah, I didn't touch it, but he put it right in front of my nose. And it was about as close to time travel as you could possibly get. Seeing something so ordinary, something so familiar, but from an impossible to imagine long time ago. He lit a spark. And I kind of never looked back after that. Unforgettable. And what was sparked in me, if I were to put it in ancient Greek terms, what was sparked in me was thauma. And that kind of translates as wonderment. It's amazement and wonderment. You go and you look at, you know, all those ancient Greek philosophers, people like Plato and Aristotle, you know, they say, do you know what wonderment does? Wonderment is the start of thinking harder about things. It's the start of, for them, philosophy. It's the start of an engagement with intellectual questions. You have to start by being amazed. And I suppose part of the thread of the book, which is a little bit of a memoir in some ways, is that I learnt what it was to have, first of all, the surprise, the gobsmacking amazement of this old piece of bread surviving 4,000 years. But I also learnt to follow that up and to think, so what does it tell me? And to start with, I think, I treated the ancient past as something that was very, very surprisingly familiar. You know, what do? In the ancient world? They eat bread. You know, they go to the lavatory. They make love. They eat, etc., etc. And I think that is one really important part of our engagement with the ancients. But I came to see that they're both familiar and very, very weird. There is a sense that you always raise the question of whether you will be able to understand them. You know, were they like you? Well, in some respects they were. Or were they really like you? Well, in all kinds of respects. Sorry, they weren't. It's that kind of tightrope of familiarity and weirdness that I, you know, it's kept me going for more than 60 years studying the ancients. And it started in the British Museum. It really did.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mary Beard is with us today. Her book is called Talking Classics, The Shock of the Old. It began as a series of lectures, but it became something more like a conversation about why the classics still matter, if they do, and why we return to people who lived thousands of years ago. And one thing you'll notice is Beard is interested in the people who don't usually make it into history, the ordinary men and women who left behind clues in their lives through graffiti on walls and household objects and fragments of everyday experience.
I think anybody who says, I'm not interested in the people on this planet who came before me, I think that's very uncurious. I mean, I'm interested in the future. I'm interested in outer space. But I'm even more interested in the people who trod my ground before I was here. And that was something I found a way into through particularly, you know, learning Latin and Greek, doing classics at university, thinking hard about the ancient world. And it revolted me in some ways. I mean, there's a lot of horrible things about the ancient world that we really do not like. We do not want to go back there. But it was perennially fascinating, interesting, puzzling. I came to see that it asked questions that kept me awake at night. What was it like to be a Roman soldier? Come on, everybody. That sounds a very nerdy thing to say, doesn't it? You know, Mary Beard, age 15, is kept awake by wondering what it was like to be a Roman soldier. You know, how nerdy is that? I wasn't a kid who buried herself just in the past. You know, I really wanted to be a revolutionary. My great role model, you know, back then was Angela Davis. I thought that political change was really important. But at the same time, I saw a real point in thinking about the ancient world too. And in wondering what humans, you know, it's about what humans are like. What do we share? You know, what do we share with people in different parts of the planet? What do we share with people who came before us? I think it's a big human question, which I would never, ever want to lose sight of.
You say that even now, it's still exciting, and this is how you put it, sometimes unsettling, the classical world. And I keyed on the word unsettling. Tell me what you mean by that, because you also use the word destabilizing. And I guess in some ways that, to me, seems to get at something you're particularly interested in. Not just that it informs the world, but it disorients us as well.
I mean, I think that's why, for me, it's been worth studying it for, you know, these 60-odd years, that it's constantly surprising, constantly undermining you in all kinds of different ways. I mean, and there are some very obvious ways. You know, I think gladiatorial combat in the Colosseum is a good one to think about. Because you do have to say, how can we begin to understand why these people, mostly men, I have to say, whose works of literature we read, who we can in some way get quite perilously close to, how can they have sat and watched people getting slaughtered, apparently for pleasure? Now, I think classicists, you know, people who professionally study the ancient world, they tend to brush that question off. They tend to say, oh, well, we wouldn't do that now, would we? Right? Well, think again, possibly, but broadly, no. But how do we begin to understand fellow human beings who were presumably not simply horrible and nasty? Doing all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you read, you read ancient works of literature and they still ask you awkward questions. I mean, the great Roman historian Tacitus, you know, is saying, what do we think empire is? And He has a wonderful phrase where he says about the Romans. He puts it in the mouth of a rebel, but, you know, basically this is Tacitus writing this. He says, what do the Romans do? They make a desert and call it peace.
Right.
And that's never gone away from me. You know, you know, has there ever been an empire in the history of the planet that has not made a desert and called it peace? Right? We're doing it still.
There's an underlying message that seemed to me to characterize your attitude about the classical world. And I want to quote you from the book here. You say, you get much more out of classics if you revere it less. So amazement and pleasure, even revulsion, are okay. But you say you're less tolerant with reverence and gratitude. This does come through in your work. And this is important to you to say that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the ancient classical world is utterly gripping and interesting.
Yeah.
It's never let me down. But I don't find myself sitting here and admiring it. I think that one of the worst things that you can do to periods of the past is revere them. You know, to think, you know, go back 2,000 years and we can see a culture that we really admire, in whose shadow we now sit. Well, you know, in some ways that's not entirely wrong, but no, they're slave owning. They are brutal. They are misogynists. Now, I think that the cult of admiring and revering is probably a better word, because it has that kind of almost religious kind of connotation. I think that probably prevents us looking at the nasty side, the messy side, the difficult side of the ancient world. You know, and the ancient Greeks and Romans and all the people around them in the Mediterranean, they're interesting because they're messy and they're difficult. And they raise questions that they can't answer and neither can we.
So I'm thinking back to the moment when you were eyeball to eyeball with the bread.
Bread, yes.
And how that seemed to be the beginning of your intellectual life in some way. And I wondered, what do you think it is exactly, if you can be specific, and maybe not, but what is it exactly about the ordinary stuff, the ordinary daily lives of these ancient people, that interests you beyond the sort of the larger thing? Because that is something you're absolutely adamant about.
Yeah, I am. I mean, I'm not uninterested in Julius Caesar, but he isn't top of my agenda, right? I think that our problematic approach to the past, it's much more meaningful, it's much more immediate to look at the kind of things that we share, to look at the ordinary. I mean, you know, people like me, I'm never going to be a Julius Caesar because I'm a woman for a start. But sorry, Doug, I don't expect you're going to be a Julius Caesar either.
I don't think so either.
I think, you know, it's not that I'm not interested in those, but I'm interested in what it felt like to be a human being, an ordinary, forgotten human being 2,000 years ago. To think about the past as that extraordinary, familiar plus foreign place, and to wonder how you can, you know, think about those ordinary people in Pompeii who left their smutty graffiti on the walls. And you think, were they like me or were they not like me? I mean, could I have had a conversation with them? Is the past so alien that we can't really ever understand it? That's the historical question, isn't it? How do we understand people a long time ago?
Well, let's embody that idea of the ordinary, as you do in the book, with the strip cartoon in the bar in Pompeii. Would you talk about that? Because you say you always visit this particular place when you go.
There is a wonderful bar in Pompeii. It's called the Bar of Salvius. In this one bar, there was an amazing painting, which kind of captures for me all that sense of what we can share with the ancient world. And it's a little strip cartoon, basically painted, but it's showing a range of characters with little speech bubbles, like in a cartoon strip. coming out of their mouths. And it's scenes from the life of the bar, right? And there is, you know, one scene in which some guy is snogging a woman, or we think it's a guy and a woman. Yeah. And he's saying, oh, I'd much rather be doing this with you than with whoever else it was. There's a scene in which a server gets a bit antsy with some kind of difficult customers, you know, and she's saying, she's got the wine. She said, look, who ordered this wine? You know, because if no one claims it, I'm giving it to so-and-so over there. Then there is another scene of a couple of blokes having the beginning of an argument about a game of dice that is in some way going wrong, right? And they, you know, one's saying, look, I'm out, I've got a two. And he said, no, you didn't, right? The final scene, though, is my favourite. It's the least well-preserved, but it's the same two guys who've been arguing over the game of dice. You know, their dispute is becoming, and I won't say what words they're using, but becoming a lot fruitier, right? And they're basically about to have a fight over this dice game. And there's this little figure of the landlord. He's pretty damaged in the original painting, but his speech bubble still survives. And he's saying, look, I'm speaking to you from Cambridge in the UK, and you know, he's telling you something that you could hear every night, every Saturday night, at least, in Cambridge, UK, when the pub shut. You know, he's saying, look, guys, if you want to fight, you get outside, right?
Right.
And you think, gosh, I've heard those words, you know, not in Latin, but in English. It's terribly, you know, I know that scene. I know the frustrations of the pub landlord who is throwing these blokes out. That is very, very immediate. The other thing about it, though, is that, you know, as I said before, there is this kind of sense of, do we really understand this?
Mm.
You know, you get the feeling that, you know, someone like me, we might walk into this bar, or we might, you know, go up and get a glass of wine and, you know, and start to join in. Could we ever join in this? Do we ever understand the rules? You know, I'm a woman. Would I be let in here, really? I mean, we see the women serving women, but is this a male place? And it's that kind of sense that we both understand what these guys are doing, absolutely, but at the same time, we just don't quite know how this whole culture works.
Yeah. I think that question, that contrast, is particularly interesting. Because you say that, so you're sort of asking these questions about the nature of the past and how we can, or if we can, experience it. And the question of whether we can, and the context for their lives is just, as you said, just so different. You call it wonderfully familiar, but also tantalizingly inaccessible. So I guess in some ways we can't imagine it. The context is just so, I mean, there's some stuff that's relatable, surely, but in some ways we just, I guess we couldn't. We can't.
Well, and that's the intriguing part about thinking about the past,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I think it's very easy to show that when you look at the Romans. You can say, look, hey, hang on, we can understand this bit. We can't understand that. This is both familiar and strange. I think that this is probably and you kind of hinted at this. This is probably something that faces at any period of the past.
Mm.
You know, people in the 19th century were very different from us, right? And we tend, when we look at 19th century history and we look at the values of 19th century history and so forth, we tend to familiarize them. And, you know, in some ways that's the right thing to do, to make them feel a bit like us.
Mm.
But they also were very weird. And the real excitement for me of the past is, you know, other people would feel this when they looked at the dark side of the moon or imagine what the surface of Mars looked like. It's kind of something you both half know and will never understand.
Mary Beard, We're talking about her book. It's called Talking Classics, The Shock of the Old. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We have the classicist Mary Beard with us today. She has a new book, which you wouldn't describe as a defense of the ancient world. It's more like a personal reflection on why we keep returning to the ancient world. So the book is part memoir and part an argument about what the Greeks and Romans can or can't teach us about our own time. And this part is the biggie. Why do these old stories still matter, if in fact they really do? The book is called Talking Classics.
One thing that you push back on in your work and in the book certainly is this idea that the classical world was the birthplace of Western civilization.
Of course
it had an impact, but you also say, you know, all cultures are this melange and mix of different ideas. But you also write in the book that rather than imagine that there are these pure nuggets of truth in the classics, you describe it as, think about it as a debate between us and antiquity. How are you imagining what that debate or conversation is like that we should be having?
Oh, it's always very tricky, very tricksy. It's very difficult and very enlightening. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, it's a bit of a cliche now to say, look, Western civilization is not a single thing, which goes back to the ancient classical world. I mean, Western civilization, whatever that is an amalgam of all kinds of things. There's Christianity, there's Islam, all in that mix.
Yeah.
Classics is very important. The ancient Greeks and Romans are important in that. And, you know, not all my colleagues would agree with me. I think that if you removed classical civilization from our own culture, you'd be leaving some bleeding chunks of stuff that don't make sense. You know, classical civilization is one of the things that makes sense of what we do. So I'm absolutely committed to two things. One is to saying that classical civilization is extremely important and it's not the only thing that's important. Mm. And I think that's your next question was what does it help us think about?
Yeah, I mean, it's I think it's the debate. What is that debate that we're supposed to be having? Rather than thinking of it as pure nuggets of truth, what's the debate that we have between us and the past?
You know, I might be an old skeptic here, and perhaps I am, but you know, I don't think there are many pure nuggets of truth out there just waiting to be discovered.
Yeah.
I think where culture does best is when it debates things constructively.
Hmm.
And one of the contributors to that debate is always, certainly in the West, more widely, what these people who were living 2,000 years ago had to say about our debates, about freedom of speech. Mm. We still read, we still portray on stage, you know, Euripides' 5th century play, A Medea, which has its focus, its heart, the moral ambiguity of the figure of a woman who kills her children to get back at her faithless husband. Now, yeah, we're still, I think you're probably doing this still in the United States, in the UK, we are still debating that issue about the role of the mother, the vengeance that mothers sometimes take on their children to get back at their faithless husbands, and how we morally evaluate that. You read a play or see a play now, like Euripides' Medea, where we wonder just how we can end that problem. Now, no one's ever going to be able to take it in. It's very, you know, there isn't going to be a society which says, oh, we've got that problem sussed, you know, let's go on to the next one. Right. That's not going to be the case. Right. But it sure is the case that we learn about different ways of thinking about it and wondering about it if we read people who thought about it a long time ago, and, you know, in this case, almost 3,000 years ago.
Mm. One of the themes in the book, and I guess in your perspective about it all, is what you call the shock of the old. That is how you look at the past, you know, multidimensionally, but also, as you say, disconcertingly new. Will you take us through that? How you borrowed that from the art critic Robert Hughes, you say, but I love it.
And Hughes, he was a great modern art critic, but no lover of ancient things.
Yeah.
Called one of his, you know, most influential books here, The Shock of the New. And what he tried to do was to say to people who thought that, you know, this was at the end of the last century, people who thought that modern art was just puzzling. You know, what is someone getting at when they just put a canvas with one red line and a black background? There was a huge kind of sense then that we don't understand what's going on. You know, what is this? Is this art? Now, what Hughes was trying to do is say, look, what these people are doing is they're trying to make you look at the world in a new way. You know, that Hughes would have, I think, thrown out all of classical art as quickly as he could get rid of it. but I can't say, therefore, it was a sort of wry compliment to him. Yeah, I said, look, classical art is shocking.
Yeah.
Right? And we know that people now, they will walk down the museum corridor. They will not think much about what they're looking at. They'll see one damn Roman emperor after the next and they'll think, one damn Venus, right? We know what this is. What I think I tried to do is to say, look, you go back to when that sculpture was made.
Yeah. And painted.
Painted possibly, it's hard to know, quite vivid, to put it euphemistically, colours. And these sculptures were shocking. When people came and looked at these things, they didn't think, oh, God, another Venus. They thought, wow. They had their moment of amazement. And one of the things I want to help people to do is to bring back, to recapture that moment of amazement. What was it like to see the first full-size female nude in the Greek world? Did you think, oh, right, okay, we've got there at last? Or did you think, this is really, this is disconcerting? And I think, and it goes along with not having much time for reverence. I want to say what's exciting for me, and I think, you know, for the students I've taught, it's to see how challenging and difficult and innovative classical art is. You know, we've turned it into reverential classics, but it hasn't always been that. Come on. It's been exciting and new and difficult.
Well, you mentioned the statue of the sleeping hermaphrodite at the Louvre.
Is
one of these examples.
Yeah, there's an extraordinary statue in the Louvre, and there are other copies of what must be the same basic ancient formula in Rome and elsewhere. And it is a statue of a hermaphrodite who has female breasts and male genitalia. Now, I think this has rather too crudely been sometimes adopted into modern debates about trans identity. I think what is clear is that we are not the first generation on the planet to think about what's the difference between a man and a woman. You know, that's a problem. It's not simply straightforward. And you see in this statue, which is much admired and puzzled over in the Louvre, you see some ancient sculptor and no doubt some ancient commissioner of this sculpture, actually trying to face head on how you divide men from women. I would suggest there has never been a time on earth in which people hadn't wondered about that. You know, now we think of it as part of a culture war, but it's always been part of some sort of culture war.
You mentioned that over the last few hundred years, the classical world has had these terrible crimes perpetrated in its name. And one of the questions you ask is just how tainted is it, you know, the past by the uses to which it has been put? And you mentioned your own reaction to that, that when you were beginning your studies, that you had already gotten a sense of the ugly side of the classics. And you describe it as gnawing away the sense of excitement that you felt and that you felt conflicted. Tell us a little bit more about that, how you managed to reconcile it or deal with it.
I think I dealt with it quite cheaply, actually, when I was a kid. You know, that I had got that sense that people were doing things in the name of the classics. You know, fascism was being underpinned in the name of classics, et cetera, et cetera. I kind of dealt with it rather in a rather teenage way that, you know, I was very keen on getting my classical homework right when I was at high school. And I got my parents, they were quite happy. I got them to allow me to put up a poster of Angela Davis over the table in the kitchen where I did my homework, you know, as if somehow that was a kind of an antidote to how other people had used the classics. But I think now you would have to be very dim not to see what, you know, very uncomfortably far-right fascist movements have made of the classical tradition, you know. Yeah. Mussolini, Hitler, they were parading, Mussolini in particular, his inheritance from, you know, Julius Caesar and Augustus. That is all true. I have absolutely no doubt, and I think that classicists have to face up to that. I think that there is a tendency to see only a right-wing appropriation of the classics. Yeah. And, you know, there is another side. And, you know, revolutionary movements, and you know this better than I do in the United States, revolutionary movements in France and in America, they appropriated the tradition of the classical world to be to underpin revolution. You know, when the United States, you know, when we had the, you know, the United States Great War against the awful King George, I'm afraid, well, King George might have seen himself in the guise of a Roman emperor, but your founders were seeing themselves as Roman quasi-democrats. You know, you get people giving speeches to get support for the cause of revolution in what was going to be the United States. They're wearing togas, right? And we mustn't forget that throughout the last 200-300 years, the classics have been, they've been a badge of sometimes very uncomfortably far-right politics. They've also been a badge of radicalism. Mm. They've been a badge of innovation. You can go to Nelson Mandela. Right? Yeah. And there he is on Robben Island, terribly imprisoned under the apartheid regime. What play do they put on in the prison of Robben Island? They put on Sophocles' 5th century play, Antigone, about the struggle of the individual against the oppressive power of the state. Now, you know, classics doesn't have a politics written into it. It's got a series of debates written into it. And those debates have been used by people on opposing ends of the political spectrum.
Mary Beard, her new book is Talking Classics, The Shock of the Old. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Mary Beard. We're talking about her book, Talking Classics.
I did want to get you to talk about the Odyssey because everyone's talking about the Odyssey right now. And of course, you do in the book, and we'll get to that in a second. But I guess you have said that you are really excited for the film, the Christopher Nolan film, because filmmakers haven't had much luck attempting this story. I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you about is why is it that the filmmakers have struggled. I guess in some ways, maybe it's that they see it as an adventure story rather than, as you've put it, something really, really more complicated than that.
Look, in some ways, I think Nolan has done brilliantly and it's going to be a blockbuster. It already is a blockbuster. Yeah. And it will do the best thing, I think. It will bring people back to reading the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. You know, that seeing the film, now read the book, and that's great.
Right.
I have not much patience with, you know, all these guys who say, oh, it's all too woke for me, mm-hmm. right? You know, how could you cast, you know, a black actor as Helen of Troy, et cetera, et cetera. Look, you know, this is a myth. You know, this story, you know, it's not true. This is not history.
Right.
You know, we can cast actors however we want them in this. You know, I recommend people going to see it. I think in some ways it's wonderful. There are some amazing bits. What I felt about it is not that, you know, that it's lost some things in the adaptation, because all adaptations of classical literature, all adaptations of anything when they're put onto film, they turn out differently.
Yeah.
I was kind of unhappy. I'm not going to say that the sex had gone, but the wonderful erotic thread that goes through the Odyssey, that had been lost. And the humour and the wit and the irony of the Odyssey. I mean, what's amazing about the Odyssey is, you know, it's probably the second oldest work of Western literature we have. And it's already joking. It's kind of being ironic about itself. And you know, I would hesitate before calling Nolan heavy-handed, but he's all very serious. And Odysseus is the greatest liar and trickster of the whole world in the Odyssey. And actually, Nolan's version is kind of a bit dour, a bit sanctimonious, a bit moralising. Mm. And I thought, look, okay, it's a free country, everybody. You can turn the Odyssey into what you want.
Yeah.
Right? But I think you lose something of the sophistication of the poem if you don't see that Odysseus is more complicated, or complicated in a different way from what Nolan has produced. So, you know, I think classicists can be very boring when they say, oh, it's not like the original.
Yeah.
Of course it's not. But you do have to think, has it lost more than it's gained? And I think in some respects, it's lost more than it's gained.
Well, I was reading reviews about this because I wanted to ask you about this. And there have been, of course, a lot of good positive reviews. But there's one that describes the way Christopher Nolan transforms Odysseus from, as this person put it, a morally complex, flawed anti-hero into a sanitized noble hero. And it sounds like that's maybe where you sort of were left with at least that part.
I think it's what I'm saying. And when I reviewed it, I said, you know, much the same, perhaps not quite so snappily. I think that it's injected a kind of, you know, forgive me saying this from the UK, I'm sorry, but it's injected a sort of Hollywood kind of simple moral value into all this.
Yeah.
You know, that Odysseus comes to see that his career of violence going back to Troy is deeply flawed and is going to bring about the end of civilization as he knows it. Mm. Now, okay, do that if you want. You know, I'm not going to sit and wag my finger at this. But hang on, there's none of that in Homer's Odyssey, you know. Mm. There's all sorts of doubts about all kinds of things. And the ancient world is always looking at, you know, at military violence and wondering what its effects are. and how you can justify it. But they don't go into a big civilizational crisis moment about it, which is what we see Odysseus doing in the recent movie.
Well, I mean, you've talked about, it seems like what you're saying is you've said that all translations, for example, like Mendelssohn's and Daniel Mendelssohn's and Emily Wilson's, that were, they're just interpretations. And I'm guessing that probably applies to movies, too. But I was also interested in the something you've said about the Odyssey written about is that one of the things you have to understand about it is that it, before it was written down, it was this oral tale, a bardic tale, and that it reflects the sophistication of those audiences, those ancient audiences, those oral audiences listening to it in a different way. Would you say more about that? I think that's so interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think Nolan tries to capture that in a way. Huh. I think it's easier for people to capture it, you know, on the page, and that's not a criticism of Nolan. But I think you do tend to imagine that early literature will be simple literature, right? We're going to tell the story of how Odysseus gets home. Well, you pick up the Odyssey and you find it's already a postmodern work of literature. It's already got flashbacks. It's got stories within stories. You know, the time dimension, the chronology gets upset. However it got composed, and that's still an open question. But, you know, if what we're going back to, and in some ways we must be, is some kind of bardic composition, my goodness me, that bardic tradition and the audiences for it were dealing with complexity of a literary form that can still be baffling now.
I want to come back to what I saw anyway is the really personal part of the new book. And you write that you've had a career beyond your wildest dreams. You wouldn't have swapped it for anything, you say, but you've never felt, as you say, 100% at home as a Cambridge classicist. And so you bring on the stage these different characters, a way of sort of making your points here. And one of them is Jane Ellen Harrison. And I guess before we get to her, could you say what ladies' Greek means? I liked this conversation.
I talk a little bit about, quotes, ladies' Greek.
Yeah.
In the book. And I've taken that quote from Elizabeth Barrett Browning's poem, Aurora Leigh, where at one point in the poem, a bloke sees some Greek handwritten by a woman, and it hasn't put on all the accents and diacriticals that a man would have learned to put on. And he just says, oh, ladies Greek.
Yeah.
Now, that is a wonderful vignette of how, in part, the tradition of classics, which has been about excluding people, women, the working class, people of colour were excluded. And when, as in the late 19th century, women thought back and they learnt Greek, they were always told they haven't learned it quite well enough. Mm. You know, they haven't learned where to put the accents on the Greek words, etc., etc. So, you know, this phrase became a kind of a sort of cliche. Ladies Greek was for women who had never been taught how to write Greek properly with all the very complicated diacriticals, etc., that men had. And to some extent, that lasted to my own day as a classicist. You know, I went up to be a student of classics in 1973. There was still a sense then that women could be very good, but they didn't quite know it as well as the blokes did. I think for quite a lot of my career, I've been so turned on by the ancient world. It's been great. But I think for quite a lot of my career, I kind of wondered whether I perhaps didn't know all this as well as my male fellow students or then later colleagues. And I suppose it's only, you know, I've had a career, say, since the mid-70s. It's only recently that I've thought, look, I don't care. right? I've got something to offer this subject. And if I don't know where exactly to put the accents on my Greek, I'll ring up one of my mates who does, who's a man, right? And I'll say, can I get this right? So I've learned a shamelessness about it. And it's been great to feel shameless. I still feel, and this is what I say in the book, that to some extent, although the world of classics is completely different from when I entered it, and I wouldn't want this to put off anybody, any woman, from coming into it, I still think maybe it's felt not quite like home. I've come to see that classics has been all the more interesting for me. And I've been able to contribute to it in different ways because I don't feel at home. A colleague once said to me, do you really want to feel at home in your subject? And you think, no. And in the book, I look back to a predecessor at my Cambridge College, Jane Ellen Harrison, who was a wonderful force of nature in some ways in the classical profession. She didn't feel at home either. Now, you can deplore that. You can say, look, the women, right up to the 70s perhaps, were not made to feel wholly welcome. But actually the women fought back. Actually the women did some of the most important things. And if the women didn't feel at home, maybe they actually contributed more because of that.
I want to come back to the story you told at the beginning about that 4,000-year-old piece of Egyptian bread. And I'm thinking about the man who opened the case at the British Museum, because you dedicate the book to him, whoever he was. And maybe say something about that finally, because the fact that he bothered to notice a little girl wanting to see something mattered to you.
Yeah, it stuck with me, and I think it's partly stuck with me because that guy noticed, you know. He noticed, and then he asked, what do you want to see? And then he did something about it. As I've always reflected, that isn't a perfect model of what it's like to be a teacher. And it's a perfect model of what it's like to incorporate people into your subject, you know, not keep them out. I mean, classics does have a bit of a tradition of keeping people out. I think that has really changed. But, you know, the tradition I'm part of, I hope, is welcoming people in, saying, come on, do it. It's fun. It's fun in here and we can all do it. And though I shall never know now who he was, I think that that's what that guy represented for me.
Final thing. So we talked about how you saw the book as more a memoir than a thesis. And I have to say, I did wonder if it was in some ways valedictory. Does it signal that you were backing away at all? I guess not. I hope not, anyway.
I don't know if what I should do next, you know?
Yeah.
I'm currently the judge of the UK Booker Prize, and that's more than a full-time job, and I haven't had a minute to think about what intellectual projects I might have beyond that. I think that it is a bit of a memoir. You know, look, I'm 71, as anybody can work out from my bread story in 1960. And I think that, you know, before you fall off your perch, and particularly if, like me, you feel so privileged and lucky to have been able to do what you want to do, you know, you do have some obligation to explain to the world out there why what you have done seems worthwhile. It's not necessarily self-evident to everybody, you know, why studying the ancient Greeks and Romans is something that is worth paying for someone to do for, you know, more than 50 years of their life. And so I did want to say, this is how I see it. Other people get lots of different things out of classics. And I'm not wanting for a minute to say, you have to do it my way. But this is my way. You know, from Bianchi Bandinelli with Hitler and Mussolini through Angela Davis to bars in Pompeii, that was my way of doing it. And I'd like to explain it to you because I think that, you know, you have a duty to make an account of yourself, actually. And I hope I've done that in a way that people feel, even if they don't agree, you know, in some way sympathetic to.
Mary Beard. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary Beard. Her latest book is Talking Classics, The Shock of the Old. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. Our email address is radiowest@KUER.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.